It is 11 a.m. Sunday morning. Good morning to you. I hope you're well. The 14th of May 2017. It's been a good start here in Manchester. The weather is glorious right now. Apparently, there's a bit of rain on the way a bit later on. We'd be lonesome without it. This is Sunday View, your Sunday View, in association with davidicke.com. Do bookmark davidicke.com/headlines. Do it now. Most of what I talk about in the course of the next hour, covered in great detail on davidicke.com. You can tweet at Richie Allen Show, email richie@richieallen.co.uk. Let's get on with Sunday View.
For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
Broadcasting live from the great city of Manchester, England. This is the Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com.
It certainly is for Sunday, 14th of May, 2017. Keep the tweets coming in. A lot of tweets already. That's good. And I hope you're in fine fettle and you've had a decent old weekend. A good weekend even might be better. Before I go any further, let me tell you where we're broadcasting. We're live on davidicke.com on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester. Check out fabradiointernational.com. We're on TuneIn Radio as well as my own website, richieallen.co.uk. There you are. Before I go any further, I want to say a massive thanks again to Mark Bajerski and to Alex Hutchison. Mark has been a long time supporter of the independent media and of this programme particularly. And he auctioned a beautiful piece of jewellery, a crystal encased in silver, over the weekend with the proceeds going to the programme. Alex Hutchison bought it for £100 and sent some more money besides as well. Alex, I won't go into that, keeping your business private. But thank you so much to both of you for supporting this programme. I really mean that. Can't find new ways to say thanks. Massive thanks to Mark Bajerski. Check out markbajerski.com and to Alex Hutchison for purchasing that wonderful piece of jewellery. Thank you so much, guys. I really appreciate it. As I'm speaking with you, the inauguration of Emmanuel Macron has come to an end. The youngest French president since Napoleon. He's in. The Rothschild man is in. And that's all there is to say about that. So I'm not going to say too much more about that and depress you on this fine Sunday morning. Said too much about it on the programme last week. So this programme is where I look at the Sunday newspapers, the headlines on the front pages, and some stories within the papers today. But before we go anywhere near the Sunday papers, there was an extraordinary exchange on the Andrew Marr Show earlier this morning. Now, that's a political flagship programme for the BBC. Andrew Marr interviews two or three political operators every Sunday. And today, live in studio, he conducted separate interviews with Defence Secretary Michael Fallon and Shadow Defence Secretary Emily Thornberry. So they appeared separately on the same programme, did separate interviews. Nothing new there, that's the way it goes. But at the end of the show, in the last 5 minutes of the programme, they sat on the sofa together. He got them for 3 or 4 minutes at the very end of the programme, together. Now, remember, Michael Fallon and the Tories have been painting Jeremy Corbyn as a terrorist sympathiser. He's an IRA supporter, according to the Tories this weekend. Listen to this exchange between Andrew Marr, the Defence Secretary Michael Fallon, and the Shadow Defence Secretary Emily Thornberry. Listen carefully.
Emily Thornberry, there's been a lot of attacks on your party's patriotism and so forth over the last few weeks. You've seen another story in the papers today about Jeremy Corbyn and the IRA. What's your message to those people who are patriotic, working-class voters, and they look at this stuff and they say, I just don't like it?
Well, I think that there were negotiations going on behind the scenes, and there were people speaking openly, and this is something which has been known for 30 years, and it's being dragged up at this particular time because there's a general election on. And I think
not
that,
surprising.
And I think, well, yeah,
you
but you know,
Prime Minister.
I know. I mean, I think the question.
The risk.
No, I understand that, and I suppose if you judge people by who it is that you spend time with, the question has to be: Do you remember where you were on the 27th of May, 2007?
I'm sure you're going to tell me.
Yes, I am. So you were in Syria and you were celebrating at a reception the re-election of President Assad with a 99% percentage of the vote. Now, I'm not going to judge you on you going to a reception with Assad, and I don't think that people should judge Jeremy by trying to talk to people who might be open to a settlement in Northern Ireland.
I think there's a little bit
is
of a...
is this true?
There was a parliamentary visit. I was on a parliamentary all-party visit to Syria back in 2007. MPs have gone every year to Syria during the better times in the relationship between Syria and Britain.
But you were at the party, weren't you?
I don't recall any party in Syria. I remember a fact-finding visit to Syria. That happened every year with MPs going out there.
Did you meet Assad when you were there?
I did meet Assad, indeed.
Shake his hand?
Indeed, I met
Assad. And you celebrated his re-election?
10 years. I didn't celebrate
his re-election. Well, that was what the reception was for. It was for celebrating his re-election.
Nonsense. It was 10 years ago. We had a different relationship with Assad here. But there's a huge moral difference between talking to other foreign leaders, and I meet them all the time as Defence Secretary, and Jeremy Corbyn's quite open support for the IRA, which was actually engaged in Northern Ireland.
It's not having open support for the IRA. You really can't just go around making this stuff up. There's an election on, and people need to make decisions on the basis of the truth. You've just said, for example, that I want to negotiate the future of the Falklands. That is... I did
that
not.
Just say it again, come on.
She said bollocks. She said bollocks. I'm going to say it again. Bollocks, bollocks, bollocks. That's what she said. And it's absolutely right. It is absolutely right and proper that people understand what just happened there. And by people, we mean people who don't ordinarily listen to programmes like this. The Tories are making libelous statements about Jeremy Corbyn, whom I don't support and whom I don't have any interest in. They're saying he supported the IRA, which is a heinous thing to say. Because the IRA, of course, here in Manchester, in Birmingham, in Guildford, Canary Wharf, many other places around the country, exploded bombs, and in many of those incidents, innocent people were killed. Now, I'm a Republican. I'm an Irish Republican. I believe in a United Ireland. And I understand where Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams and people like that came from. And I spoke about this on this programme before, okay? These guys grew up out of a brutal policy towards Catholics in the north of Ireland. I'm not going to get into all of that. But Jeremy Corbyn didn't support violence. He was against internment without trial. He was all in favour of peace talks. He was in favour, ultimately, of the British Army's presence being removed from the north of Ireland. But Thornbury was brilliant there. Where were you in 2007? And Fallon said, well, nonsense, we didn't meet. And, no, you did. You went to meet and to celebrate with Bashar al-Assad after he won a landslide in the general election in Syria there. Terrific stuff, that. And I wonder, I spoke briefly just before coming to air with David about that, and David said, you know what? Probably just as well it came at the very end of the programme. Give people a chance to put that into perspective themselves. So, rare bit of genuine journalism on the Mara show, but coming from the Foreign Secretary, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, Emily Thornberry. Just to finish that up, this is how it went from there.
That is untrue.
just 20 minutes ago, you implied sitting there that
you really just can't make this up as you go along. People need to make decisions in this general election based on facts and based on information, proper information. And it's not right for you to go slinging around dead cats the way that you do. People need to concentrate and work out, because there's a serious choice to be made.
And you've told us, your excuse is Jeremy Corbyn is on some kind of journey. But that is too great a risk for this country.
In relation to NATO,
soft on terrorism.
In relation to NATO, there has been a change.
Wants a demilitarized
zone. And we are clear.
And it kind of petered out a bit there. Very interesting exchange today. Bollocks, says Thornberry. In fact, the comments made by various... I don't know of any incident in British political history where a minister... Where a senior minister, so Jeremy Corbyn is basically the leader of the opposition, so he's the shadow prime minister. I don't know of any incident in British electoral history where a very senior politician sued another one for libel. But the statements made about Jeremy Corbyn are the definition of libel, that he supported the IRA. Interesting stuff. To the papers then. The time, 9:30 past the hour, Sunday morning. May 14th, the Sunday Telegraph front page headline, NHS cyber chaos hits thousands of patients. You won't be surprised, a lot of this in the papers today, because this has been the big story for the last couple of days. The Sunday Telegraph writes, thousands of operations and other appointments will be cancelled, as bosses admitted, that's NHS bosses, that it will take several weeks to fix aging computer systems hit by Friday's cyber attack. The NHS admitted vital equipment, such as MRI scanners and X-ray machines, have now been taken offline because they cannot be repaired immediately. And thousands of NHS staff are bracing themselves for problems tomorrow when they turn up for work tomorrow, Monday, and attempt to log on to their computer terminals. Senior sources telling the Sunday Telegraph that as many as tens of thousands of procedures could be disrupted and many thousands of appointments cancelled. Senior British Medical Association sources said they didn't recognise the picture painted by the government. Investment, investment, investment. We spoke about this many times. Underinvest equals damage, equals eventually destroy, equals public outcry, equals let's privatise it piece by piece. Think the aforementioned David kind of phrase, problem, reaction, solution, which we mention often on this programme. Underinvest, damage, destroy, public outcry, then privatise. Now in May 2015, so 2 years ago, the government ended its $5.5 million deal with Microsoft. Microsoft were providing material security support for Windows XP. The government dropped that and didn't do anything else. So what about that, Mr. Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt? How can you explain for that? How can you account for that? Well, in the same newspaper, the Sunday Telegraph, there's another story with the headline, Jeremy Hunt ignored repeated warnings over system vulnerability. And the story says the NHS failed to heed repeated warnings that its out-of-date computer systems were vulnerable to the sort of cyber attack that brought it to its knees. So the question for Hunt is, why did you scrap the deal with Microsoft to provide the material security support? Hunt isn't fit for purpose, is he? Right? That's the sort of thing that would get anybody else sacked. You know, that's probably criteria number one on your to-do list. Protect the IT systems within the NHS. But the inexplicably cancelled security support for 2 years ago didn't put anything in its place. Jeremy Hunt has questions to answer. You know what I would say, of course, because I say it all the time. I pull a little cord on my chest. He should be fired with prejudice. No support deal and left the door wide open for these attacks. Here's your P45, pal. You've put people's lives in danger. The Sunday Mail, same story, front page. NHS had 66 alerts but did nothing. So it gets worse. So apparently there were 66 other attacks on NHS computer systems in the UK in the last 12 months alone. The newspaper lays the blame squarely at the door of Jeremy Hunt, calling it an astonishing failure that none of the incidents were reported to the police. Why? Why? Because it's all part of a systematic destruction of the service so that we will go bananas. And after we kill all the immigrants, because it's their fault, it isn't their fault. Doesn't help, of course, open door immigration, but it's not their fault. They're human beings just doing the best for themselves. It's not their fault. But when we get done with them, will we realise that this is all part of a systematic destruction of what's rightfully ours in order to hand it over to Hunt's fat cat pals in the city? That's what's going on. Sunday Express moving away from the NHS and the hacking. Sunday Express front page, May to smash Maggie record. The Sunday Express reports on a poll that predicts the Conservatives will win a massive landslide. They're going to win 398 seats, according to the Sunday Express, and they'll have a majority of 147, breaking the record Thatcher holds from 1983 when Michael Foot got absolutely hammered. Way back when. The newspaper also says Labour is predicted to win only 157 seats. That's the Sunday Express. I wouldn't read too much into that if I was a Labour supporter. The Sunday Times: May pledges council house revolution. This is a serious story. And speaking of bollocks, which is the word of the day, the Sesame Street word of the day, according to Emily Thornberry, is bollocks. And it is. May pledges council house revolution. This is bollocks. Let me tell you what they are saying, the Tories. Theresa May, by the way, if you're listening overseas, there is a massive, massive, massive shortage of affordable rent property in this country, state-owned property for people on very low incomes. It doesn't exist anymore. Theresa May says, whether you rent or buy, everyone needs the security of a place to call home, but too many ordinary working families are stuck on council waiting lists, facing unaffordable rents and struggling to save for their first deposit. May went on to say, that's why we will fix the broken housing market and we will support local authorities and housing associations to build a new generation of council homes right across the country. Wait for what she says next, dear listener. Brace yourself. Giving tenants a new right to buy these homes when they go on the market will help thousands of people get on the first rung of the housing ladder, and fixed terms will make sure money is reinvested so we have a constant supply of new homes for social rent. Giving them a right to buy, a new right to buy these homes when they go on the market. What's revolutionary about that? What is revolutionary about that? The deals require these houses to be sold after 10 to 15 years, with the tenant in them getting the right, the first right to buy at the point of sale. It is utter madness. How many times have we done stories on this and have we had guests talking about this? These houses should always be owned by the state and kept for families who cannot afford to buy. They should never be sold. Because when they are sold, massive property developers and developer companies come in, buy them and charge astronomical rents to people like me. This is insane. I'm in South Manchester, 2.5 miles from the city centre. All of the houses in my area where the studio is used to be owned by the state and used to be affordable. Used to be rented to people for an affordable rent. All of these houses. But Thatcher introduced right to buy. Margaret Thatcher, the paedophile apologist, the protector of paedophiles, amongst other things. And it's all relevant, by the way. She introduced right to buy not for the benefit of the tenants, but because they always wanted to privatise those houses. They knew those buyers would eventually sell or default or remortgage. So many people have done that. We met so many in Spain. I remortgaged my council house and I got up to my bloody neck in debt. I've had to sell and get out. That's why I'm in Spain now. This was pre-financial crash, by the way. Okay? You see what I'm saying here? So people like me and you, those of us that are in the rental side of things, we're paying 60% of our income on rent. £800 to £1,000 per month on rent. I pay £900 a month here. And this is a huge pillar of the Hunger Games society, remember. They do not want people owning a home. Not that it matters, really. Because you don't own the land your house is built on. As I've gotten into many times on this programme with David, who's been writing about this for years, and other people. Check out the land registry. You don't own anything. You might own a few bricks and a bit of mortar, but you don't own out. More on that thing in Buckingham Palace later on. Also in the Sunday Times front page, this is the thing that Michael Fallon and Emily Thornberry were talking about. Sunday Times front page, Corbyn's IRA demo arrest. A terrorist sympathiser. The story is Jeremy Corbyn was arrested in 1986 taking part in a protest by IRA sympathisers to show solidarity with accused terrorists including the Brighton bomber. This is according to the Sunday Times. Corbyn joined a picket outside the Old Bailey to oppose the show trial of a group including Patrick McGee, who was subsequently convicted of murdering five people at the 1984 Tory party conference. McGee was also convicted with the other defendants of planning a bombing campaign in London and at seaside resorts. Again, the truth about this is Corbyn did not support the murder or the bombing of anybody. He opposed internment. He opposed imprisonment without trial. He opposed secret trials. He opposed evidence being used against people that had been derived through torture. That is what Corbyn opposed. The Times are spinning it like he supported terrorism, which undoubtedly he didn't. I'm no friend of Jeremy Corbyn's. I have no interest in him or the Labour Party. The Sunday Observer. Interesting story. Headline, front page. Millionaire Brexit donor targets 140 Remain MPs. Who's the multimillionaire? It's Jeremy Hosking. He's a city asset manager. He told The Observer he would spend hundreds of thousands of pounds targeting MPs who backed staying in the EU despite representing areas that voted to leave. So if you're an MP and you backed staying in the EU but you're in an area where the electorate voted to leave, Jeremy Hosking is going to try and get you out. The move is going to exploit divisions in Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, according to the Sunday Observer there. All these stories, by the way, available online at the websites of the newspapers mentioned. That's the Sunday Observer. 21 minutes past the hour. Well, it's 21 minutes past 11 UK time as I record this. The Richie Allen Sunday View in association with DavidIcke.com. Bookmark DavidIcke.com/headlines. The Sunday Mirror front page. Diana Lover fights for life. James Hewitt is unwell. Now, I've met James Hewitt several times. I mentioned this a long time ago when I was working for Talk Radio Europe in Spain. James Hewitt used to pop in from time to time, and once or twice he took part in the newspaper review Monday political programme that Talk Radio Europe used to host. I hosted it once or twice. He was fronting a restaurant, I think called a Polo House, I think, for a time. He popped in. I met him briefly, spoke to him on the radio once or twice. Couldn't make head or tail of him, really, of who he was, really, who he was deep down, really. But found him obviously fascinating because of his association with Diana. I must point out, when I spoke to him on the radio, he was absolutely adamant that no interview would ever cover any of his time with Diana and wouldn't cover any of his associations with the royal family. So I've got to get that right out there. But he lived in Marbella. He was a bit of a player and he used to pop into Talk Radio Europe, and I interviewed him once. It was very brief and it was about really the news of the day. He was on a panel with two other people. That's a long, well, it's not that long, but it was 6-7 years ago, I suppose. So he's had a heart attack and a stroke. All the papers saying the 59-year-old former army officer needed emergency surgery and doctors gave him a slim chance of survival, according to the reports. He's now said to be recovering. News of his illness comes just weeks after he gave a rare interview denying long-standing rumours he is Prince Harry's real father, which is repeated. This claim is repeated in the new BBC Two drama King Charles III, which is an imagining of the royal family with Prince Charles as King Charles III, or the third, maybe I should say third. Right, so the interweb is alive with claims that James Hewitt has been attacked, he's being silenced. I don't know about that. He's always denied being Harry's father. But then again, if it is true and he is Harry's father, old Phil might think, why take a chance? That's old Phil, who recently retired. Bit like Casino. Bit like the end of Casino, you know. Do you remember at the end of Casino when the old bosses are deciding who needs to be executed and who can stay alive when all the indictments are being handed down? All the old bosses are like, no, Hewitt's solid. Hewitt's solid as a rock, Phil. He's a Marine. He'll never squeal. He's a great guy. He'll never squeal. He's a good fella. And Philip says, why take a chance? Might take a chance. Call MI6. Maybe. Maybe that's what happened. I have no idea. Maybe Hewitt has been attacked. Maybe the spectre of the documentary, not the documentary, but of the play King Charles III, and all this mention again about Harry's genealogy, right? His lineage. Maybe somebody said it's time to get rid of former Major Hewitt. I don't know. Tell you what we are going to do, though. I've just had an email from somebody saying, tell us more about Hewitt's restaurant. There was a restaurant in Marbella called Apollo House. I don't know if it's still there. And Hewitt was fronting it up. There was other money behind it, but Hewitt was the front man for it. And what he would do was he would wander around the restaurant and chat with the diners while they were eating and drinking. I never went there. Couldn't afford it, to be honest. I think the prices are absolutely astronomical. Never went to see the restaurant, but that's why he was in Marbella. It was short-lived, and he went back to the UK after that. Round about that time, or just before then, he had been trying to sell letters to him from Princess Diana. That didn't go down very well with people here and people who supported Diana. But like I said, I didn't get to know him very well. Just met him when he popped into the Talk Radio Europe studio. So I couldn't get really much of a sense of him. And I never got to ask him about whether he's Harry's dad or not. Of course I would have if I was allowed. I would have said, yeah, are you Harry's dad by any chance? So that's the papers. Very quick break. When we come back, some really interesting stories that I want to get into in some greater depth. This is Sunday View.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Virtually every transaction that involves a child is valuable to somebody.
We intend to show everyone the real reason children are being removed at an alarming rate.
No, this is awful.
The baby's not been seen by the doctor or nothing.
They are psychopathic.
They have got the legal right to kill children now, because that's what they do.
Traffic 2. Available now at premilonpictures.co.uk.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Yeah, old Hewitt is a Marine. He's solid as a rock. He'll never talk. Why take a chance? Paul Curtis, good morning. Good morning, Dean. Good morning, Cartoon Drunk. Mark Anthony Taylor, Kate Coley, Anne Selly, Mark Morrison, Beatrix, Sean, Gail. Mark Morrison, I could be here all day. Loads of tweets coming in on all these issues today. Queenie as well. Good morning, Queenie. La Antenna, of course. Good morning, mate. Hope you're well. John Larson and everybody else who's tuning in to Sunday View today, 28 minutes past the hour. 28 minutes past 11. We can say that today. Let's move on then. Let's move on. By the way, I interviewed Liz Crokin the other night. And Liz was very, very good. And we'll have Liz back in the future. She's investigating VIP paedophilia in the United States. Now, this morning, somebody calling themselves Banan Alan sent me a tweet saying this. Why you get scared about not naming the musician? I thought the truth needs to be produced and you're worried about libel. Seems contradictory. What a plonker. What a plonker. If that's your real name, Banan Alan, how about I allow a guest come on this show and call you a paedophile? How would you like it? Eh? Because libel holds journalists to account. You cannot go about claiming someone has done anything, unless you can prove it. End of story. And that's why certain campaigners, or alleged campaigners, in this country have never been and will never be allowed on this programme, because they make claims against people with no proof. And libel A successful libel case against this programme would end it. And it's easy for Muppets on Twitter to libel people and to claim that people are paedophiles. People that have got nothing. They've got nothing to lose. I've thousands of pounds worth of radio studio equipment here. Okay? My broadcast partners, David Icke, Fab Radio 2, ACR in America, TuneIn Radio. These broadcasters are equally liable if I allow somebody, call somebody a paedophile, and there's no evidence to support it. So we don't allow people, we don't allow guests on this programme. And that's why you will hear me sometimes say, listen, don't mention any names, I'm warning you. Do not mention the name. Okay? It's not because we're scared. It's because it's the right thing to do. End of story. Enough of that nonsense. Muppets. Anyway. The reality for many people in the UK today, it's 1:30 by the way, is poverty. Extreme poverty. That's the reality. It is a subject that the mainstream media in this country will not touch. Poverty is killing people. Suicides are rising exponentially. And children are becoming chronically ill because of poverty. Here's a distressing in terms of the reality of what's being said, but a terrific report from RT. Listen to this.
Poverty is making children sick. That's the warning from paediatricians up and down the country who are urgently calling on the next government to save future generations. A report which surveyed 250 medics found that two-thirds of them can link low-income households to ill health in children.
I see children who come into the emergency department with all sorts of complications due to poverty. For instance, just recently I had a boy who was 4 years old and who'd come in with his legs were bowing, he had skin problems because his mum couldn't afford to feed him food, fruit and vegetables. He had a chronic cough and chest infections because she couldn't afford to move out of their cold, damp flat. And because she was so busy trying to juggle two jobs, really worrying about her financial concerns, she was too busy to talk to him. And his language abilities were lagging well behind other kids of his age. So that's just the kind of tragic case that I see on a regular basis in the emergency department.
And from this report, you're here in London, but children throughout the country could be affected in this way. Is it regional or is it nationwide?
It's absolutely nationwide, and I think that's one of the interesting things about this survey, which obviously covered the whole of the country, is that this is not just something that we're seeing in London, which is known to be a city that's full of inequality, but actually something that's actually pervasive across the whole country, and that's something that's new and has developed in the last few years.
It's something that's new and has developed in the last few years, she said. That was Dr. Goody Singh from the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. David calls it a Hunger Games society. It's by design. It's not a consequence of bad management of the economy or a consequence of the financial crisis or a consequence of the deficit. It's by design. This is by design. And I refer you to a wonderful man who's been on this programme several times called Professor Alex Scott Samuel, who is the Professor of Public Health at Liverpool University. Great guy. We disagree on the feasibility of changing things through politics and through the ballot box. But he's a great, great guy. And Alex accepts that this is basically not ethnic, but this is social cleansing. This is killing people, basically. Children starving, children developing chronic illness, psychological problems because of poverty. Imagine it. Because it's a mad world, right? It's insane. Came across this as well over the weekend. A policeman was sacked for refusing to shoot a suicidal man who was armed, but he wasn't really armed, he had a gun with no chamber in it. This is the world we live in. A former police officer is suing the city of Weirton Police Department in West Virginia. Why? Because he was fired after he refused to shoot at a distressed black man. Stephen Mader, God love him, and I hope he's in a better place. No, that's not the name of the guy who died. I'll tell you the name of the guy who died in a minute. Stephen Mader is the officer. We hope the victim is in a better place. Stephen Mader says he was fired to protect the officer who shot the distressed black man in the head. You couldn't make it up. This is Stephen Mader, the officer who was fired, who wouldn't shoot the guy. This is his account of what happened.
I see a black man standing outside of his car. And I tell him, I said, well, we got to call it about a domestic guy here. You want to tell me what's going on? And he says, no, man, I don't want to talk. There's nothing going on. You can leave. As I'm running the trunk of his car, I see he's got his hands behind his back. So I ask him, I said, show me your hands. And he's backing away from me, and he says, no, man, I can't do that. And I see a silver pistol in his right hand. So I draw my weapon, and I tell him, you know, drop the gun. He says, no, man, I don't want to do that. Just shoot me. In my mind, I'm thinking, why is this happening this way? And then once he says, you know, just shoot me, it's kind of like a click in your head, like he's being suicidal. It was a matter of seconds between me initially coming into contact with him to when the other officers had arrived. The other officers get out of their vehicles, their weapons are drawn, and they're yelling, put down the gun. And then within seconds, as he's waving the weapon, one officer ended up firing 4 shots, and the last one hit the man in the head. Someone calls the police at their worst time. You don't want to go in there giving them the mindset that the police aren't here to help. You want to give them the mindset that they're there to solve the problem and to help you in any way you need.
And while Maeda was reluctant to shoot, one of his colleagues did, ultimately killing the 23-year-old male suspect. Now, later it emerged the man's gun was not loaded. After that incident, the local police department filed a case against Maeda for failing to act and for placing others in danger. The department said Maeda's was fired for not meeting its standards and struggling to think clearly during a critical incident.
Yeah, it sounds like he was the only person thinking clearly, Mr. Maeda. And the man, the gentleman who was murdered by the police officer, because he was murdered, was Ronald Williams. And he was 23. He had serious problems, and he phoned the police himself. Right? Stephen Maeda, the police officer, was the only one thinking clearly. This guy is distressed. He phoned us. He doesn't want to kill anybody. He's suicidal. Let's have a chat with him. But before we can move to that, his psychotic mate blew the guy's head off. Talking to the man, getting him some help. No. Let's blow his head off. But you didn't kill an agitated man with obvious problems, you're fired. It's a madhouse. It's an utter madhouse. It is a madhouse. Jesus. 23 minutes to the top of the hour. Jeremy Corbyn. Now, you know that the Labour manifesto was allegedly leaked last week, and in amongst the leaks were plans, the Labour Party plans, if elected, to nationalise the railways, to take the Royal Mail back, amongst other nationalisation plans. Now, should Jeremy Corbyn win the election, and it's not likely, let's have a look at those plans. Sky News did, and I can't believe I'm saying it. Sky News conducted a very good interview with Cat Hobbs. Who is Cat Hobbs, you might well ask? Well, Cat is the founder and director of We Own It. Now, We Own It is a campaigning organisation that is against privatisation, and they make the case for public ownership. Let me read you what We Own It says on their website. They say, we love public services, trains, water, energy, care work, council services, the NHS. We believe they make life better for you, me and everybody. They are super useful and really important for our children, parents and grandparents, our friends, colleagues and our communities. We all use public services every day. But privatisation is damaging our public services. We've been told we've been told myths about privatisation for over 30 years. We don't believe them anymore, if we ever did. It's time for a new common sense about the public services we love. We pay for them through taxation. We use them, so we spend money on them. Therefore, we should own them, says Cat Hobbs. I really like Cat Hobbs. This is her conversation with Sky News.
We know that public ownership is really, really popular. When you look at YouGov polling, you can see that for the Royal Mail, for the energy companies, for the railway companies, there's a majority of people in this country who want to see these services brought into public ownership.
But that cost of renationalising Royal Mail, £4 billion, I mean, there's better ways to spend money when the government's got a £50 billion deficit, isn't there?
Well, I think we need to take a long view, which is exactly what the government didn't do when they sold off the Royal Mail. The Royal Mail was sold off for around £3 billion. At that time, it was making a profit profit of £300 million a year. So we've done research with the New Economics Foundation showing that within 10 years, we're going to be worse off. The British public will be worse off because of that sale. Now, that was a short-term decision, and we need to take some long-term decisions to bring public assets into public hands. How much would you compensate shareholders? That's a question that would have to be decided. But is it a good deal to have public profits going back into the public purse? Absolutely.
Well, let's have a look at the railways then. I mean, rail privatisation has been a huge success in terms of passenger journeys. Passenger journeys have doubled in the last 20 years. In the 35 last years of British Rail, they fell by a third.
Well, under British Rail, we saw a lot of underinvestment by the government on purpose. But what I would say is if you're a passenger and you're looking at the outrageous fares that people are paying, which are the highest fares in Europe, if you're on a packed carriage trying to get to work, I think you'd question the idea that our railways are a success.
Well, hold on, that's because we're trying to get the passengers themselves to pay for the railways rather than taxpayers. That's a good thing, isn't it?
Well, the thing is that if you brought the railways into public ownership, you could actually save £1.2 billion a year. And that money could be used to reduce fares or to make better services.
How do you work that out?
So that's from a Rebuilding Rail report that basically shows the money from the shareholder profits, but also the money that comes from having a more integrated system. Because right now, our railway is very, very fragmented, and it's a real mess. So if you integrated that system and you reinvested the profits back into the system, you would have a more efficient system.
Yeah, she said underinvestment on purpose, didn't she? In there, like, traditionally, there was underinvestment on purpose. We love Cat Hobbs. Cat Hobbs is good. I'm going to give Cat Hobbs a ring and get her on this programme before the election. She was speaking with Sky News' Ian King there. Everybody knows. It is an open fact, an open and well-known fact that Gideon Pigeon Fancier Osborne sold the Royal Mail for less than it was worth. Many times have I said that. Boring the shite out of you. A massive public asset making a profit of £300 million a year. And the thieving bastard Osborne sold it for a song. And you know about the shareholders, by the way? Fuck the shareholders. Couldn't care less about the shareholders. They were party to a crime. Party to a crime. Sorry. Sorry. But shareholders, you know, the family members of the Corleone family and the Genovese family, you know, when the things they stole were taken back, you know, the affiliated family members didn't get any compensation, right? Screw the shareholders. All of this stuff should be nationalised. And if it's making £300 million a year profit, that's money that could go straight into the NHS or anything else. Do you want to laugh? Because it can get you down, this nonsense, right? Do you want to laugh? I'll give you a laugh. Alistair Campbell, the horrible propagandist for Tony Blair. Alistair Campbell, accessory to the murder of millions. You know who he is, right? Disgusting man. He's doing a series of filmed interviews for GQ magazine. This week he spoke with Anthony Blair. Don't watch it. It's nonsense. It's an hour long. It's on YouTube now. It's nonsense and it's full of the same excuses for Iraq and all the same old lies that you'd expect. But there is a very light moment at the end of it. Campbell asks Tony Blair about Labour's relationship with Rupert Murdoch. Have a listen to this and listen real carefully.
Murdoch.
Yeah.
So did we get too close to Murdoch?
Well, you know why we did get close. We got close because we'd been absolutely savaged by the media throughout the 80s and early 90s.
But we kept it on for quite a long time. Only really fell out of Murdoch when he started, you know, getting...
Yeah, but it's a different... Look. I mean,
who's
I'm
the worst
the person...
of those two?
No, no, okay.
Dacre and Murdoch.
He's asked them about Wendy Deng. Do you want to hear the start? Because you might have missed that. He mentioned Wendy Deng. You fell out with Rupert over Wendy Deng, he said. Have a listen to this.
Yeah.
So did we get too close to Murdoch?
Well, you know why we did get close. We got close because we'd been absolutely savaged by the media throughout the 80s and early 90s.
But we
90s.
Kept it on for quite a long time. Only really fell out with Murdoch when he started, you know, getting...
Yeah, but
about
it's
Wendy.
It's a...
Wendy. No, I couldn't almost like Alistair Campbell. No, I could not, but that is comedy gold. And Blair can't think of what to say next. Wait, did he mention Wendy
I
Deng?
I have changed...
Did he say Wendy Deng?
My view about...
Did he fucking say Wendy Deng?
The media, because of come to Brexit. No one could ever be quite as...
So let's just admit it.
Campbell is laughing his arse off in the background. Thought you might like that. 15 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. Very quick break, back with more. And I have plenty more for you. This is Sunday View in association with davidicke.com. Bookmark davidicke.com/headlines.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Virtually every transaction that involves a child is valuable to somebody.
We intend to show everyone the real reason children are being removed at an alarming rate.
No, this is awful.
The baby's not been seen by the doctor or nothing.
They are psychopathic.
They have got the legal right to kill children now, because that's what they're doing.
Traffic 2, available now at premillionpictures.co.uk.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
Right, welcome back to the programme. It's exactly 13 and a half minutes to the top of the air. Sunday View with me, Richie Allen, broadcasting live on Fab Radio 2, TuneIn Radio, my own website, richieallen.co.uk, and davidicke.com as well. Moving on, back to Michael Fallon, the UK Defence Secretary. He was on the Andrew Marr show this morning. Earlier in this programme, we heard Emily Thornberry basically say that he was talking bollocks, which he does. She does a lot of the time as well, but this morning she definitely carried the day, no doubt about that. So he was on the Andrew Marr show. They had separate interviews, as I mentioned. Marr asked him if there was any post-Second World War conflict that he wouldn't have supported. And Andrew Marr made the point that Iraq and Libya ended in disaster. This is how that exchange went.
See, you've been very, very critical of Labour on the nuclear issue and defence generally.
And rightly. Look at that.
Nonetheless, they might say that the problem with your side is they want to talk first and bomb later. You always want to bomb first and talk later.
No.
Can I ask you, is there a single war since the Second World War that you haven't been in favour of?
Well, when we voted on the Iraq War, we were under the impression given by the then Labour government.
But you voted for it.
I voted for it, a lot of MPs, because we were told there were weapons of mass destruction there. And it turned out, actually, there weren't.
Were you wrong, and do you regret voting for that war?
Well, I regret the prospectus on which it was embarked. It was
But you regret voting for it?
Well, hang on. Yeah, I regret voting for it on the basis there were weapons of mass destruction, because they clearly weren't. But we were dealing with a dictator who had invaded other countries, and we were part of an international coalition. And the problem with Labour's approach is they're now saying they would never commit. And you even heard Emily Thornberry now suggesting they might negotiate over the Falklands. I think that's shocking.
Well, which he said was a lie.
Another war that you supported. You were very much in favour of use of force in Libya. And let's read you again the Foreign Select Committee report on what's happened in Libya after the war that you were so keen on. It resulted in political and economic collapse, inter-militia and inter-tribal warfare, humanitarian and migrant crises, widespread human rights violations and the spread of Gaddafi regime weapons across the region and the growth of ISIL in North Africa. In short, it was a total disaster and you voted for it.
Well, the, re- The reason for it, if you remember, was to prevent a humanitarian catastrophe in Benghazi, where an entire city was potentially going to be wiped out. That's why we had the intervention. Now, you're right. When you do intervene, we need to learn the lessons of each of these conflicts, that there needs to be a proper plan for stabilisation afterwards. I've been working with other defence ministers in the coalition for precisely that in Iraq, after Mosul is eventually liberated, that we stabilise these areas and bring in security after the war is over, to ensure that the Sunnis there, for example, have a proper stake in the running of their country.
Yeah, more bollocks. And Mara didn't challenge any of this. Stabilisation. Interestingly enough, not intervening and not destroying these countries isn't an option. Non-intervention is not on the table. We'll have to learn the lessons, said Fallon. How about we stop? No such question from Andrew Marr. And stabilisation is the new buzzword. How often have you heard Ike talk about when the language they begin to use collectively, all at the same time, and why they do it? The Trump administration is cleverly using this term now all the time. Stabilisation. And what stabilisation actually means is it means regime change and nation building. Right? They can't say regime change anymore because there's no support for the US to remain in Afghanistan and in this part of the world indefinitely. There's no support from the populace for this nonsense. So Trump, his press secretary, Michael Fallon, Amber Rudd, Theresa May, stabilisation, which is a continuation of the neocon policies of the administrations that came before Trump. Nation building is getting their man or their woman in every country in the world. And that includes Emmanuel Macron in France. It's out in the open. Guy's a Rothschild president. Right there. There's no hiding it anymore. That's what they're doing when they talk about stabilisation. It's all about the push for global governance. And if you don't believe me, listen to a clip that you've heard once or twice on the programme before. Richard Haass is the president he's the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, which of course is part of the Round Table Group. Look it up. These guys take orders from the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, the royal families, and through their minions in DC, in London, in Tel Aviv, and everywhere else, they develop government policies. Listen to Richard Haass talking about the New World Order.
After the 30 Years' War and the Treaty of Westphalia in the mid-17th century, you had this major innovation. It really was the great big idea of its era, and that was the idea of forming nation states, and that they would be based on this concept of sovereignty. And sovereignty had two dimensions. Essentially, countries would not use force to change the borders. And second of all, they would respect those borders, that what happened within the territorial confines of a fellow nation state was their business. Essentially, it was a mutual hands-off society. And that was a big idea. It may not sound like much, but before then, you had a world of nonstop intervention. So this actually was a constructive big idea. And for the last few hundred years, this has been the basic structural idea of what I would call World Order 1.0. It was often violated, World War II obviously being the most dramatic. More recently, Saddam's invasion of Kuwait, Russian action in Crimea. But it still was the ordering principle. And my argument is it's necessary but not sufficient. That in a world of globalization, increasingly what goes on inside any country is no longer its business alone. And my purpose is not to say we want to get involved in its politics, but think about it. If there's terrorists operating out of that country.
Pandemics.
Right. Climate change. If they're having tremendous amount of coal-fired generating plants, with hackers. Mm-hmm. Basically, you can't use your territory as something to hide behind. So my argument is we have to respect it, but if sovereign states are going to derive the benefit of sovereignty, they've also got to meet the obligations. And what I'm arguing is that this ought to be now the next operating principle for the world. I call it World Order 2.0.
Sovereign obligations.
Sovereign obligation. Mm-hmm. And this ought to inform the consultations the United States has with others.
Yeah. World Order 2.0. In a nutshell, sovereignty is dead. We'll come into your backyard if we don't like what you're doing. Whatever the excuse might be, global warming, terrorism, pandemic, whatever, we'll come in and do whatever we want to protect the greater good. Richard Haass, President of the Council on Foreign Relations. That's it right there, the agenda laid out in front of you. Sovereignty is dead. 6 minutes to the top of the hour. I'm going to finish with this story. It's Sunday, May 14th, 2017. This is the final story for today, but it's an important one as well. The Anti-Defamation League, based in New York, which believes that everything is anti-Semitic. Everything. They're saying hate speech has skyrocketed since Trump was elected, and there's a need to do something about it. In the clip, you're going to hear Peter Levy from the Anti-Defamation League. This is Sky News on the ADL in New York, saying that hate speech has skyrocketed since Trump. You'll hear the Sky reporter, and then you'll hear Peter Levy from the ADL.
The Anti-Defamation League tracks anti-Semitic hate incidents. They've doubled in a year and noticeably increased since November's election. They don't blame the president, just the political climate.
Actually, the most alarming statistic in my mind has been of all the incidents, there's been a 106% increase in schools, elementary, middle, and high schools. Kids are hearing and seeing modeled in the greater community this type of hateful rhetoric, and it's emboldened them to share or experiment or push those envelopes, right? My concern is that this becomes a new normal.
But the data collected on hate crimes here in huge and sprawling Southern California could offer some help. Researchers are using what happens here to see whether hate crimes can be predicted by patterns of hate speech on social media.
If we can raise the awareness
Minority Report.
Among the community about different hate crimes, and then also give police tools for identifying areas where they need to put more resources, then we'll call that a win.
Yeah, you see, this is Minority Report. This is pre-crime, the pre-cogs. We'll monitor hate speech, and that's anything we say that it is. If we say it's hate speech, therefore it must be hate speech. We'll monitor that. We'll use that to predict who might be, about to commit a hate crime. You heard it right. And I covered this briefly the other night, talking about artificial intelligence. The police here in the UK are about to use artificial intelligence to help them predict who might be and who might not be about to commit a crime. So how many more steps are there between that and actually arresting some person who hasn't committed a crime, but arresting them for the, you were about to commit a crime tomorrow. Put your hands out, you're under arrest. Jesus Christ. 3 minutes to the top of the hour. I'm going to finish, absolutely final story. It's just breaking as I talk to you now. Bear in mind, when you listen to this programme on a podcast and you listen to it on YouTube, it has been recorded at 11 a.m. to midday UK time on Sunday, May 14th. Europol have told the BBC, this is breaking, that the cyber attack on the NHS on Friday has actually affected more than 200,000 victims in 150 countries. That's according to Rob, I haven't lost the ability to pronounce my R's. Rob Wainwright, Europol chief, has said the attack has affected 200,000 victims in 150 countries. In fact, he spoke to ITV today. It's being reported by the Beeb, but he spoke to ITV. He said the world faced an escalating threat. Ooh. And there was concern about the level of potential attacks tomorrow. They're bracing themselves for massive attacks tomorrow. The virus took control of users' files, demanding payments. Russia and the UK were among the worst hit countries, so they can't blame it on the Russians. I'm going to leave you and love you as we approach midday this Sunday. Thank you so much for listening to the programme. Let me just ask you, kindly, if you haven't made a contribution to this programme before or made a donation and you are in a position to do so, please go to paypal.me, that's paypal.me/Richie Allen, paypal.me/Richie Allen. But there are bank details as well as the PayPal details on richieallen.co.uk. So my website, richieallen.co.uk, has got all the payment details, but you can go to PayPal and it's paypal.me/RichieAllen. Do support this programme if you're in a position to do so. I think it's worth supporting. You might say, well, then again, you would do, wouldn't you, Richie? Listen, have a great rest of your Sunday. Let me just tell you, because the mother-in-law arrived on Friday, she's only here till Thursday morning. I'm not going to be with you tomorrow, but there are no less programmes. I will be doing a programme next Friday, this coming Friday, okay? So I'm back with you Tuesday with an exclusive on the programme. Don't miss it. Tuesday at 7 p.m. BST, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and there'll be a programme on Friday to make up for tomorrow. So I won't be with you tomorrow, but I will be back with you on Tuesday. Look after yourselves and one another. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. Thank you for participating.
Broadcasting the information the mainstream media won't touch. This is the Richie Allen Show in association with DavidIke.com.